CCFM is the community radio station for Bristol
and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with old Labour economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. With nowhere near enough paid work to go round, and those jobs there are not paying enough to live on, are the bankers laughing at us while we work ourselves to death? How much did it cost to buy our government? And how long are we going to put up with the war on Britain by fraudsters dining in private members' clubs, walking the streets of London? Britain's economic terrorists and their political poodles in Downing Street. So tonight, the censored story of the cuts. One man spent his life predicting the present financial crisis and spelling out solutions, but hardly been heard at all. He's the convener for decades of the UK Green Party's economics group and publisher for nearly 20 years of Sustainable Economics magazine and various other publications, Brian Leslie. He'll explain what's gone wrong with our money system and how to fix it. But first, can you provide indoor camping site for Bristol Folk Festival visitors? The organisers of Bristol's Folk Festival this year have launched an urgent appeal for a venue that can be used as an indoor campsite, if you've ever heard of such a thing. The festival at the Colston Hall has been revived after a gap of 32 years and takes place from Friday, April the 29th to Sunday, May the 1st. Joint organiser Steve Parkhouse, who has a programme here on BCFM, said we had two places lined up but have been let down. He said other festivals like the Cheltenham Folk Festival always have arrangements for people to camp indoors, but this will be the first time it's been tried in Bristol. He said we're looking for somewhere, ideally within walking distance of the Colston Hall, where people can put down their sleeping bags and where there are toilets and somewhere to make tea and coffee. That's pretty simple, isn't it? Mr Parkhouse said they'd need the use of the venue for Friday, Saturday and Sunday nights. He said the venue could be a church hall, community centre or part of a school. Steve said the festival goers will be arriving on Friday, April the 29th, and leaving on Monday, May the 2nd. The three-day festival includes headline acts such as Seth Lakeman, who is also the event's patron. Also appearing in the event, a West Country duo, Show of Hands, and the 11-piece folk band, Bellowhead. Mr Parkhouse said if anyone can offer help to the venue, do contact him via Bristol Community FM, that's office@bcfm.org.uk or studio@bcfm.org.uk, or you can call him or text him on 07931 411 014, that's 07931 411 014. And also, for those people who are listening last week to our feature about the Sneed Park allotments, if you remember, something like £1 million worth of council rent that could have been collected but wasn't because these refurbished prefabs were just left to rot. We had an answer from Bristol City Council about what's happening with this site from Peter Wood, who's a spokesman for the council. He said full planning consent for this site was granted in March 2010. The clearance of the site will begin later next month, so that's in March sometime. The demolition of existing houses, that's those existing prefabs that were refurbished and then never used, and building of 11 new private homes to follow. This site is a complicated one, and planning permission came with 20 conditions which have had to be met before work could begin. I think it's Bovis Homes that are rerunning that site. The site is in the grounds of a former manor house, which is a conservation area, and parts of the site contain listed structures, e.g. boundary walls, one of which has a building attached. This building will be preserved, so that one won't be demolished as the rest of them will, and it won't form part of the new development, so we'll be looking to sell this off. So if you're looking for somewhere to live in Sneed Park and you've got plenty of money, then there's a nice place to live there. Or actually, I think the place is open at the moment, so you know, you might want to go and have a look. So joining me in the studio is Brian Leslie, who I introduced a little while ago. Brian, hi and welcome to Friday Drive Time.
Hello Tony, and hello all the rest of you.
Okay, so Brian, can you just introduce us to how you got into monetary reform? So I understand you've been doing this for a long time.
Yes, I can say I inherited the interest. My father was campaigning from the 1920s on monetary reform. He was part of a group which started from the investigation of its founders' ideas into the funding of the wartime factory that he was auditing, and he noted that the amount paid out in wages, salaries and dividends was less than the cost of the products, so the factory as a whole could not in fact buy all the products. He found that that applied to all the factories, and he noted then that that First World War had been a struggle for markets, with every country, every advanced country, trying to sell abroad goods that they couldn't sell at home, not because they weren't wanted by the population, but because the population didn't have the money to buy them. So he decided, he analysed the thing and said that the way money is created and distributed doesn't lead to a sane society. He went on to predict that if the system wasn't changed, then there would be inevitably World War II. And when the crash came in the end of the 1920s, the interest in this money issue grew rapidly, and there were study groups all over this country and all over the English-speaking world, at least, if not the rest of the world, and there was a massive increase in discussion on the BBC, in trade unions and everywhere. Of course, we got the Second World War, which miraculously solved the credit crunch. Miraculously, there was no shortage of money for production for war, and so the subject was dropped. Now, after the war, I heard the announcement of the first elections in Canada, in which British Columbia had a landslide victory for the Social Credit Party, which was the monetary form.
So, Brian, are you saying that it was actually a party dedicated just to monetary reform as their major plank of their an entire political party in Canada?
Yes, in fact, in 1936, Alberta had elected such a government with an absolute landslide victory. The first time they stood, they got something like, I can't remember the exact figure, something like 57 out of 61 seats. But, of course, every bill that they put forward to introduce it was squashed either by the federal government, or if it got through that, by the Privy Council, which then had superior legislation. So it was never actually introduced.
Privy Council was a sort of vestige of the old colonial, wasn't it? Yes, okay, sort of controlled by the Crown, probably.
Yes, anyway, getting back to this broadcast, 1 o'clock news, I heard the announcement of the landslide victory and a few paragraphs explaining the aims of the Social Credit Party. I then listened to the 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock news in the evening. They didn't even mention the election. And from then, the question of the way money is created and its effect on society has been absolutely off the cuff, off the record on all public broadcasts. And equally, I find that the education of economists ignores the history of money creation and the relevance of the way that it is created to the problems that we have today.
Now, we're also joined by old Labour economist Martin Summers, as always here. Martin, what about the way you were educated? Does that tally with what Brian was saying there about it being a kind of skewed version of economics?
Absolutely. I mean, as Brian will know, there are fashions in economics, and what you get taught depends very much on when you were taught. But monetary reform has never been seriously looked at except in times of crisis.
Since the last World War?
Yes. But I was familiar, there was a strong Social Credit Party in New Zealand as well, wasn't there?
Yes.
Keynes, who is often thought of as a mainstream economist in the general theory of employment, interest and money, which is probably the most influential economics book written in the last century, the final chapter he talked about Silvio Gesell, and Keynes himself was interested in monetary reform. He saw his proposals to reform the existing system as a first step, and monetary reform would obviously be an important second step, because in actual fact most people don't realise that money is not created by the government, which is what made monetarism in the 80s such a farce, because you've got all of these private sector institutions creating money, but without actually, and the government pretending that they were ultimately in control of it. And the monetarist experiment in the 80s collapsed when it was I think it was Sir Alan Walters was advising Lady Thatcher, and he said well, actually, the monetary base, M0, everything comes back to that in the end. But, of course, it doesn't. In actual fact, money is just an agreement amongst people to pay. And the private sector generates by far the majority of it. So the banks basically print the money, which is why they're so profitable.
Yes, it's estimated that over 97% of our money now is bank-created credit.
Well, the leverage levels on this have gone up enormously, and all of these derivatives.
Martin, when you talk about the leverage levels, what do you mean?
But the banks used to have to keep a certain amount of money back in case there was a run on the bank. But those, I mean, Ben Bernanke, who's the head of the Federal Reserve in the US, that was arguing tongue in cheek, I suppose. I don't know whether it was tongue in cheek. We ought to get rid of reserve requirements altogether, since in actual fact banks just print money willy nilly. We might as well just accept the inevitable and let them print money willy nilly.
Okay, so what you're saying is essentially that banks are clicking buttons and putting money into people's accounts, maybe lending them, giving them overdrafts and things from money that they're just creating out of nowhere.
That's what John Kenneth Galbraith said many years ago. He said in the book about the crash, the Great Crash, he said, "The creation of money is such a simple matter that the mind revolts from it. Such a great mystery ought to have something more complicated about it." Basically, banks make up money, then they lend it out at interest, and then they make money on that. And it's actually a racket, as is now becoming very, very apparent, because the economy is now in a very big mess as a result of this system.
Can I just quote a phrase from John Kenneth Galbraith? "The study of money, above all other fields in economics, is one in which complexity is used to disguise truth or to evade truth, not to reveal it."
Okay, so can you cut through some of that complexity and some of that economics jargon, Brian, and explain to us what is actually wrong with the way things are today?
Well, if you first remember that over 90% of our money is created by banks along with interest-bearing loans, that means that all the money in circulation, virtually all, is paying interest to the banks on its issuance, which means that the banks are charging the rest of the economy interest simply to have a money supply.
Is that actually, you know, so even the money in our pockets, if we've got any at the moment, you know, even the money in our pockets is only there because it's got to be then eventually paid back to somebody with interest?
Essentially, yes. Of course, the notes and coins are issued by governments and spent into circulation without any debt created and interest charges on that debt, but they are nowadays a tiny part of the economy. At the end of the last World War, still over 40% was notes and coins, and at that time, of course, we could afford all the rebuilding and all the free education, free health service, and all the council house building and so on. We can't afford that now, essentially because the government is not creating, it's virtually creating none of our money. The Bank of Canada, of course, was nationalised before the Second World War, and government spending for that war and for two or three decades after that was mainly by borrowing from the Bank of Canada. Now, this is not as good as actually creating the money and spending it into circulation, because it still was clawed back and cancelled as loans were repaid. But at least any interest on that went back to the government for national benefit. But with
quantitative easing, is it?
No, the... can you help me?
The neoliberal consensus.
Neoliberalism, that's the term I was thinking of. They stopped borrowing from their bank and started borrowing from private banks, which was great for them, of course, and in theory it was to save them from collapse, but it was at the cost of the whole nation, apart from the banks.
So really, the banks are almost like holding a gun against the head of the public through the government, saying, "Well, look, you know, we are actually controlling the oil in the machine now, and unless you do what we want, then there won't be enough oil going into the machine." And of course, many businesses now are crying out for even short-term loans and overdrafts just to keep them going. And the banks are saying no.
Yes, in fact, essentially, for a very long time past, the banks have been the hidden government. They pay the politicians to get elected, and they see that they carry out the laws that they want. Of course, the banks are in trouble now because not only the build-up of debt means that people can no longer afford to service their debts, but also, of course, the banks are in competition with all the money manipulators, all the derivatives and hedge funds and so on, who in fact are soaking up the wealth even more than the banks at the moment.
I think that's right. We've reached the end of the line. I mean, this is the time to start talking about this because the existing system has failed. Most people find most of these topics rather hard to follow, and when society seems to be functioning and the banks seem to be there and you get your money out of the machine and the government seems to know what it's doing, then people are by and large inclined to go along with the status quo. But the status quo is not an option, not as we sit here now. The private banking system is effectively bust. All of these profits which they claim to be making are based upon accounting fraud, really. They've been allowed to mark all of the junk that they've got on their books at full price, when in actual fact, if they tried to sell it in the market, it would be sold for a fraction of what its face value is. So when Barclays says, we've made a huge profit and I can have a £9 million bonus, that's on the basis of Enron-style accounting. Because if we went through the books of the banks properly, we would find that they were all bust. And nobody wants to face up to the fact that the private banking system is bust. We're going through all sorts of crazy denial. I mean, denial is not just a river in Egypt. It's also going on at the heart of the banking system. And we're going to come a cropper sometime very soon, and then the ordinary people will have to face the fact that that system of banking is finished for good.
Can I just make a quote? The Bank of International Settlements estimates that the global total for derivatives at 1.1 octillion...
Okay, what is an octillion? Have we heard of a trillion?
A really big number.
More, bigger than you can actually... I suppose that's... Yes. What is that, 1,000 trillion or something?
I don't know how many millions. Yes. I can't count up. It's nearly 20 times the product of the planet.
Yes, so in other words, the money in circulation supposedly is 20 times what the actual production is. And that just shows you how out of kilter this system is. I mean, all of these profits that are being made are essentially what's the financial sector has become parasitic. It's sucking capital from everybody else into the pockets of the people who work in the fire insurance and real estate sector.
And of course, most of that is used in further gambling. It's not allowing people to buy the products that they've...
Yeah, I mean, we've got a classic case of this at the moment. The stock market is booming as the economy crashes. I mean, you couldn't say anything more. I mean, how out of kilter is that? Some people are making a packet and other people are going to the wall. But this is World War III, never mind World War II. This is what happens. When the system crashes, as it did in the 20s and the 30s, you're on the road to war. And that is the real danger we face.
Now, this week, Mervyn King, or as I've been calling him on the show, this week, King Mervyn, because we're talking about the bankers being in charge here, aren't we? So yes. Mervyn King is the governor of the Bank of England. This week, he began by announcing the latest figures on inflation, which aren't looking too good. We were all hoping that because the Bank of England's lending rates are so low, that there wouldn't be too much inflation. But unfortunately, that's not what he announced this week. And let's have a listen to Mervyn now.
Good morning, everyone. In January, CPI inflation reached 4.0%, well above the 2% target, thus triggering a further exchange of open letters. But monetary policy has to be forward-looking, and so the real question relates not to its current level, but to the outlook for inflation in the medium term. Inflation is likely to remain high over the next year, and higher than the committee expected 3 months ago. That mainly reflects further sharp increases in commodity and import prices in the past 3 months. Gas and oil prices have risen by over 15%, and food prices by about 20%. Taken together with the increase in VAT last month, those factors mean that prices are likely to rise sharply in the first half of this year. But unless food, energy, and other commodity prices continue to rise at the same rate, CPI inflation will then fall back. Inflation is likely to remain high throughout 2011 before falling back thereafter. In the medium term, the best collective judgment of the committee is that the chances of inflation being above or below the target are broadly equal. But there are real differences of view among the committee about the likely path of inflation in the medium term.
King Mervyn there, speaking earlier this week, and by the way, the CPI he's talking about there is the Consumer Price Index. Martin, I think I'll start with you. What is he exactly saying there? Because he seems to be saying, I mean, talking about 20% rise is over a year. I mean, this is just a quarter he's looking at, but that's extensive. You know, food prices going up by 20%. He's also talking about a sharp rise in the first half of this year in prices.
Well, I mean, we were talking about the monetary overhang in the international system before that clip, and what is happening now with the money that they've been bailed out with, the banks are speculating in commodity markets because they've also been deregulated. So now they've created a bubble in oil, a bubble in wheat, and this, of course, is forcing up food prices and energy prices.
So what are these bubbles?
Well, a bubble is where lots of money gets chucked at something, and if you've got enough money to chuck at it, you can rig this so that it carries on. So you buy something cheap, and then the price carries on rising, then you sell it and you make a profit, and then you go back in and keep pumping the bubble up. You see, markets don't necessarily clear at some kind of supply-demand price. There is clearly supply shock in terms of food because of all the weather events that we've been having. But what this speculative system does is any little shock, it becomes completely exaggerated. What you need to do, in fact, is squeeze speculation out of the system so that people get stable long-term prices and they can make plans what to produce and what to do. But the real problem with inflation rising is not... You said earlier that interest rates are really low and therefore that should bring inflation down. In actual fact, there's always a danger of inflation breaking out when interest rates are too low. What the danger is because if inflation's creeping up, there will have to be an increase in interest rates to keep the markets happy, and at that point you crash the economy. So we won't. The danger of inflation is that you have to put... We're going a bit too fast, we have to put the brakes on. But the problem is, it's like, I think, I can't remember whether it was Keynes said, it's like pulling an elastic which is fastened to a brick. So you raise the interest rate to try and bring inflation down, and you're pulling on the elastic, the brick isn't moving, you raise interest rates again, brick isn't moving, and then it shoots across the room and hits you in the eye. That's what will happen. It means that the options for the Chancellor are closing down.
Well, actually, Mervyn was being rather calm, wasn't he? He didn't sound
That's
like
his
he
job.
Was... and he was saying that after maybe the summer, maybe into the autumn and winter at the end of the year, everything will be calming down again and inflation will, you know, there will be less and less inflation and less to worry about.
I'll be very surprised if any central banker say anything otherwise. They're not supposed to go out there and say, panic everybody, the end is nigh. That's not their job.
On the other hand, if I can quote a couple of bits from his speech to the second Baxter lecture in New York City in October, one thing he said is reform is necessary. One example would be to divorce the payment system from risky lending activity, that is, to prevent fractional reserve banking, for example, as proposed by Fisher in 1936, Friedman in 1960, Tobin in 1987, and more recently by Kaye, 2009. And he would like to eliminate fractional reserve banking, which explicitly recognises that the pretense that risk-free deposits can be supported by risky assets is alchemy.
Martin,
and he finally said, of all the many ways of organising banking, the worst is the one we have today. Now, this is Mervyn King, Governor of the Bank of England, saying that.
Do you think maybe he felt a little bit freer to talk when he was over in the US rather than when he's sitting down at one of these inflation announcement meetings?
Well, I think it's very significant that somebody in his position is clearly considering monetary reform as a serious option. So the idea that this is some kind of wacky, greeny type thing that nobody serious takes seriously is obviously wrong, which that quote clearly shows. Whether you see, the problem is these things are not decided upon what's the rational solution. It's decided on the balance of forces within the society. The wealthy bankers have aggrandise this money and power to themselves, and then they buy the political process. And there's a problem with trying to present people with, look, it would be rational to do something sensible. They don't want to do something sensible. They like it the way it is. And that becomes a political problem rather than an economic problem.
Now, it's all very well talking about this in money terms, but how does this affect us practically day to day? Now, one of the most harrowing symptoms of the economic mess we're in right now is that increasing numbers of people cannot afford to live on the wages that they get. Channel 4 News' Gary Gibbon this week visited Salisbury in Wiltshire to meet some of those having to visit free food banks because they don't have enough money to feed themselves and their families, even though they're in work.
First delivery, a classic case of what the food bank is seeing. A two-income household that's gone down to one income.
Hello.
Hello.
Julie and her partner have a baby daughter. They're trying to cut their costs fast to make the £700 a month her partner brings home go further. But like many others, they've found themselves plummeting into very hard times.
Shall we open it up and see what's in there? Do you want
one? Very much.
Good stuff.
Everything that we need.
You've got an income coming into the house.
Yeah,
and a lot of people scratch their head and think, well, in Britain, surely you can afford to put food on the table. You've got an income.
Not with the rent that you pay private landlords, the electric, everything else, council tax. It doesn't even pay for any of that at the moment. It's just, it's hard, very, very hard. As soon as the money's in, most of my bills aren't even paid for because I haven't got it. And I think I'm so stubborn, I'd just rather struggle than... But I'm health as it said, they're here for you, just take it. I'm not the only one out there.
Next stop, another classic case the food bank is seeing. Alex's regular work as a school bus driver normally keeps her and her 11-year-old daughter above the poverty line, living in a one-room bedsit. But when 2 weeks sick leave turned into 2 months, her income nosedived.
You always think it happens to other people because you always budget and you try and make sure that everything is fine and you go to work and you do your bit and so on. And I never thought that I would need food from other people. I never expected that. Someone said that to me 5 years ago, because I'm always working. I always make sure that we have everything that we need. And it wasn't, so it was very, very hard.
When you went for the parcel, was the cupboard nearly bare?
Yes. Yeah, it was getting very low. And my fridge now at the moment is still very low.
The local MP says, if you've got one income coming into the house, there's you, there's the little child, surely one income will cover your costs and put food on the table.
No. Having a child, you need nappies, wet wipes, everything you need for a child. I'm struggling with all that as well. It's all, every day, essential needs. It's just not covering.
No luxury goods.
No, nothing. There is nothing.
Everyone we spoke to has had tax credits and other benefits they're entitled to. But when income drops suddenly, they're not enough. I went to see Andy, a builder, who, like hundreds of thousands of others in the workforce, gets all his work through agencies now. 1 month he can bring in nearly £800, the next just under £180. When construction work froze in the cold snap in December, pay stopped. And not for the first time he needed food parcels.
There's no secure work anywhere now. And the only work I can get is agency work. And I just keep backwards and forwards.
They keep laying you off?
Yeah. Get a job with an agency. Say a month or 2 months down the line, back on benefits. And it's just like that all the way through. And it has been for the year.
He's worried about eviction, so his priority, when money is tight, is to pay off rent arrears.
I'm worried about losing this place. Most of it's got to go on that, to get rid of those rent arrears. As I won't have a home, so I do without food sometimes. That's why I go to the food bank. That is the only thing I can do at the moment. Other bills just get chucked to one side. And all the time they're getting chucked to one side, they're accumulating as well, like your water. And council tax, you know, it's just difficult. What do you do? You've only got X amount to play with.
The food parcels come from items donated by shoppers as they leave the local supermarket. Those donating weren't surprised to think people in the streets around them could be tipping into crisis.
What sort of people do you think are actually in a place like Salisbury needing a food bank?
It wouldn't surprise me if it was families, to be honest. I mean, we're quite financially stable, and yet lots of my friends now have got massive mortgages, they're in negative equity, they've got lots of overhead, and they now can't pay their bills. It's not a good time.
And you're hearing of people who are sort of
close to falling into trouble. I know people. I mean, ordinary working people, we're all just a few months away from disaster, aren't we? If the money's not coming in, you can't pay the bills.
That was Gary Gibbon on Channel 4 News there earlier this week with the report on the food banks. Now, Martin, rent, mortgage, gas bills, water bills, getting to and from work, electricity bills, council tax bills, phone bills, VAT. Once they're all paid, there's not a lot left for food, is there?
No, and a fundamental cause of the crisis that we're in is that real wages have stagnated since the mid-70s in the US and in Britain.
We've also heard of people having to take pay cuts.
Yes, but the thing about... I mean, you see, the economy used to work quite well when we had strong trade unions and a kind of a government management system in place for managing macroeconomic imbalances. And the idea was to make sure that people did get wage increases, solid wage increases, year on year, related to their productivity increases. That was broken, that link between wage increases. Productivity has carried on growing, no doubt about that. It normally does in a developing economy. But that's not been passed on as wage increases to ordinary people. Real wages haven't risen in the United States since 1973, and it's now 2011. Now, what happens, of course, is people carry on trying to have the lifestyle they used to have when wages used to rise year by year. And how do they do that? By borrowing. And, of course, borrowing is never going to be a solution. And that's the problem. We need to get back to a situation where the bosses used to understand, as Ford, Henry Ford used to understand. His principle was that the people who are working on building my cars should be able to afford to buy them, because otherwise I ain't going to be able to sell them. But that's all gone by the board. We now live in a fairyland where derivatives are going to feed us all, but it's not going to happen.
Anyway, we're joined by... our monetary reform,
Right, I was wanting to say that this is obviously a reversal from the 60s when Macmillan said we've never had it so good, but then I could see that we could have had it a hell of a lot better, because what we're suffering from is wage slavery. We're not distributing the wages of the machine. As machinery takes over the productivity, the people should be able to enjoy that benefit. Instead, it's frittered away in profits, which people can't use for the actual buying and selling of things needed. It's put into gambling and money laundering. And the basic problem is the way money is not only created, but the way it's distributed. We need, essentially, as machinery takes over, we need the income distributed as a basic income, a citizen's income, which is an idea which the Green Party has held from its start, and the Social Credit Party in the 20s was arguing for. The Georgists, the land value taxation people, were also arguing that the rental value of land, which is a monopoly, that should be the basis of money to distribute fairly to all the population.
Now, I think many of us understand that it can't continue the way it is. Certainly, as the amount of debt repayments are getting bigger and bigger, and the actual income that's coming into the government through taxation seems to be contracting, we've got a serious problem coming up in the future. So, for someone that's spent most of their life looking at this problem, how practically should we be dealing with this right now?
The way which the government and the bankers controlling the government are not likely to accept without a massive public pressure, which I'm glad to say is gradually growing, but it needs to grow a lot faster. We need to have the government, we need to stop banks creating money, period, and instead the government should be creating the money needed and spending it into circulation.
So you're talking about the Treasury, really? Rather than Treasury borrowing money from the city, the Treasury should actually be creating that money itself?
Well, I think Positive Money, their Bank of England Act, has it right. It's true that we can't rely on government not to oversupply and cause creation, we need an independent state body to decide how much money the economy needs, create that money and pass it to the Treasury to be spent.
But the Bank of England is independent.
Well,
Why can't the Bank of England just do this?
Well, it could if the law were changed to stop fractional reserve lending and give the Bank of England the powers to create that money and pass it to the government for spending into circulation. That is what the bill proposed, and a similar bill is being proposed in America by the American Monetary Institute, and Dennis Kucinich, a congressman, is putting that to the American government for debate as well.
Now, Martin, we were hearing from Mervyn King earlier that there's been a bit of dispute over the last month or so on the Monetary Policy Committee about which is the way to go. Do you think that anybody is talking in Britain about the sort of things that Brian's saying there, to actually have some kind of independent way of producing money that's
one person is obviously talking about it, which I wasn't quite aware of, is Mervyn King. So it's being talked. I mean, you can see that there might be a bit of a vested interest there. If the Bank of England got control of printing all the money, so you could say, well, that's possibly why he's interested in having it. But in any case, it's a rational policy. I think the time has come for these things to be seriously discussed. Quite clearly.
And what about the fact that we control Lloyds and we control RBS because we're the government, the Treasury, is the major shareholder in these banks?
Yes, but at the same time we don't seem to be able to tell them even not to pay their bonuses, never mind anything else. I mean, we're still in denial, as I said earlier, about the idea that the private banking system is bankrupt. They're still talking about when we get back to normal. We're not going back to normal, that's not going to happen. And I'm afraid there's been a semi-normal. What Gordon Brown and others did in 2008 was inject us with a huge lot of morphine. We've been in a car crash, but we've had a load of morphine, and now it's wearing off, and we're going to realise that every bone in our body is broken. And at that point, ordinary people are going to realise that something has got to change. The real danger, I'm afraid, is that most people don't understand all this, and they're likely, for example, to join fascist parties and blame the immigrants or blame the people on the other side of the road. Or I used to be an aid worker in Yugoslavia, and you saw as the economy collapsed that all of the hatreds and tensions which were submerged came to the fore. And we've seen this before in the past. In the 30s, rational solutions were not adopted until it was too late, and basically the world spiralled into war. Look at what's happening in the Middle East. There's rebellions going on everywhere. There's a real danger that could crash the stock market, you know. This fighting in Bahrain.
What's that got to do with?
Because it's all to do with oil price. Yeah. So all of these things are linked. And at that point, there are so many ways in which the crash could happen. I'm fairly convinced that there will be a crash because there's so many different ways in which it could happen. But at that point, we need to be ready with serious proposals to do something sensible.
Okay.
And I'm glad to hear that there are some.
Well, we'll be talking to Brian about that in a moment. But first, who is to blame for the financial crisis? Marina Morris has been out on the streets this week to ask you about the causes of the financial crisis, the wisdom of the cuts, and who's to blame for it all.
In the current financial crisis, the result of the last Labour government's overspending, or of an international banking crisis?
The easiest thing to say is the last Labour government, but I think they did make a lot of mistakes. But there's always outside pressures as well from other countries. I think it's basically, a lot of it is down to Labour government's outlook on life and not keeping control of their spending.
I think it's probably more of a long-term issue over the last 30 years where they've got away with a lot of risks they shouldn't have taken. It's only recently come back to haunt them, and that's, I don't think you can hold it down to one administration.
I think it's the international banking crisis, so it's not because the government, it was because the whole situation in the world.
I think it's more international than anything to do with the Labour government.
Who should be blamed for the crisis?
Probably the same people as always have. Middle classes, because the rich will get find ways of getting around it, and the ones that are on social security or benefits still get those regardless. It's the vast majority of people wage earning and trying to pay their taxes that will once again pay it.
Probably the FSA, because it's not regulated properly, the government for not tightening up, and the banks just taking silly risks. Yeah, all three.
Of course, banks, yeah. All the banks, yeah, that's what I think.
The banks.
What do you think about the cuts?
Cuts have got to come. I'm not saying that I agree necessarily with the way that they're distributed. Some of them are. It's like anybody. If they haven't got the money, you can't spend. And in the hope that two or three years' time, we might have some get back to a more normal situation, we have to cut at the moment, same as everyone does. Well, as I just said, you need the cuts. Tax rises, I think, will come, but nobody likes to sort of put it up. But there's lots of ways, like the last government had, of raising taxes without necessarily putting it on the PAY system.
Well, the cuts are necessary to stabilise the financial climate. So I think people always prefer cuts before tax rises. But then again, it all depends which services get impacted first.
Fortunately, I don't take any benefits, so for me it's nothing really bad. So I don't feel anything about these cuts. Fortunately, the tax rises is not the best thing, so I don't like that.
I think they're necessary evil.
Is it right to increase the tax on banks?
Once again, it would be the people in the middle classes, that will pay it, because the ones that have got bank accounts will pay it in charges anyway. Although they say that they are going to tax the banks, who owns the banks and who are the people that put the money into the banks? So that's where the money's going to come from.
Yes, obviously it's right to tax the banks because it was their fault.
I don't know, really, it's not my thing. I think it's probably banks.
Yes, definitely.
One of the interesting things that's come out there is this whole thing about the middle classes, because I find that quite fascinating. The idea being that the rich are so rich, Brian, that they can avoid tax by putting their money abroad and whatever. The middle classes are somewhere in the middle, and the poor are on the poverty line anyway. So if there's going to be the taxation is going to be clawed away from anybody, it's going to have to be the middle classes.
Well, I would like to suggest that, in fact, it is quite possible, given the political will, to tax the rich. It's a matter of their influence on government avoiding them doing that, especially the influence of the bankers as money controllers. There is clearly an international banker's aim is to have a world government with a world currency controlled by the banks. But getting back to this question of governments creating and spending the money, the usual cry is that that will be inflationary. Well, I'd like to point out, first of all, how much inflation we've had over the last few decades, or especially the last few, but in my lifetime. I mean, I bought a house in 67 for under £5,000. It's now worth over £500,000. And, you know, when I bought, it wasn't difficult for moderately well-off, I was only moderately well-off people, to start buying a house. Now it's virtually impossible. You've got to be quite rich to be able to buy a house at all. As far as the government causing inflation by creating too much money is concerned, and there are proposals, this is why the proposal is that there should be a specially directed monetary policy section of the Bank of England, with the mandate to decide with open discussion, open to scrutiny, how much money the society needs, and to see that that amount is maintained in circulation. This would keep it independent of government. It would be like the weights and measures, British Standards Institute, independent of government, but it's a government body, lays down regulations according to the scientific needs. Well, equally, this should be open to scrutiny. It should be mandated initially to keep inflation under control, but I think eventually lots of other considerations need to be brought in to decide how much money society needs. But one thing to remember is that at the moment, interest charges are a major problem, mainly because of the interest charged on the money supply. It's estimated that, on average, about half the cost of everything you buy is due to the interest charges in the costs that build up to that final price. And if the money is issued enough for people to be able to live without having to borrow in the main. I mean, I'm not suggesting it would avoid all borrowing, but if we had the right sort of money supply spent into circulation so that there was no debt attached to the existence of the money, then there would be very little interest built into prices. So prices should be able to drop by about 50% from what they are now.
Martin, what about this point that Brian was making there about the climate now being so different to what it was a few decades ago, and it being so difficult for people to afford basic things like actually to establish a home? Even for a married couple now, it's a very difficult thing to do.
That's right, because basically the economy wasn't perfectly managed in the 50s and the 60s, but there was a consensus across the board about how things should be done, which was thrown overboard in 1979, 1980, but during the Thatcher-Reagan era, and a lot of our problems are coming from that. Monetary reform would have made things better even in those years, as Brian says.
Yes, I can absolutely agree that that has made it get so rapidly so much worse, but it was heading that way.
What's happened now, this isn't the inevitable crisis of capitalism. It didn't have to be like this.
It would have ended up further in the future.
Yes, so I mean, this kind of super capitalism, turbo capitalism, which has been inflicted on us for a generation, is basically capitalism using up all of its moral assets in one go. I think that coming out of this, one of the problems I have with the idea of a monetary institute providing the money supply is that I think it's also important, and I think you probably agree with me, that the government still has to have some fiscal discretion, and that the decision to tax and spend is not taken away from the democratically elected government. The money supply is almost like the interest rate, the monetary policy, but the fiscal policy would still be in the hands of democratic politicians. They could decide to raise taxes on the wealthy, for example, to buy more nursery schools, and the monetary business would be neutral to that.
Martin, if I could just intervene there, what are you saying? What would you say to what Brian was saying there about the international bankers actually sitting down and saying, well, actually, what we really want is a big financial currency, one currency that we control?
Well, I think that's probably what they'd like, but I suspect there's going to be an awful lot more chaos before they get to their nirvana. Basically, they can't manage the existing setup, never mind a new super duper setup with even more of everything built in their favour. That's what they'd like, but I don't think they're going to get it.
Well, I'm sure that is what they're aiming for, and this is why they've encouraged the development of the euro and now the Amero they're working towards.
Yeah, what's this Amero then?
This was to be a currency shared between Mexico, Canada and the United States to replace their national currencies. It's was seriously put forward. I think it's at least been dropped for now. I think they probably plan to raise it again. But
but wouldn't it be actually quite a good thing to have a global currency? One, I mean, for years and years, the dollar worked quite well as a sort of reserve currency right across the world.
It used to be linked to gold. I think that ended.
Yes, I think there is a place for an international currency, but it depends very much who creates it, who controls it, what's the basis of it.
Well, what don't the IMF do that now? To a certain extent, so they have these things, special drawing rights, don't they? Where they go and lend to all different countries in different currencies, I imagine.
Yes, but this is all linked with all the monetary, what's wrong with the money system in general. Various reformers advocate, in fact, a mixture of currencies, local, national, and global. And Bernard Liotard, who developed the euro, he was a Belgian banker, developed the euro, then came to realise how terrible the system was, and he's a strong advocate of local currencies. I'm not against local currencies, but I think a properly functioning national currency is the first need, and if that doesn't work well between the areas of the country, there's no reason why people shouldn't be free to develop a local currency, but I don't think myself that there would be a need for such.
Now, within the Eurozone and certainly within Europe, there are all sorts of problems right now. We've heard about the ways different countries are coping with it, but two examples which are kind of useful to look at. First of all is Iceland, who have decided to renationalise the bank which had been privatised, their national bank, and then Ireland as well, which is having an election at the end of this month, really, around the fact that there's a lot of controversy in Ireland about what their monetary policy should be. We've had the IMF coming down to Dublin and telling the Irish government really what to do and how to sort their economy out. So, Brian and Martin, maybe you first, Brian, what do you think about those two options, and which would you as a monetary reformer prefer?
Well, I would say the essential first step is for each nation to take control of its own monetary issue, its own monetary supply. Then they can discuss with other countries the basis of their exchanges.
Now, that's essentially what the Icelandic government has done, because they've stepped in, haven't they? And they've now said, well, we're actually bringing this back under government control, this bank and our money system. But the Irish haven't done that.
No, and I know that the people from the Icelandic government were at our last Bromsgrove group meeting discussing these ideas of monetary reform and so on, so I'm hopeful that that could happen. The other thing that makes me hopeful that we may get change in the right direction, of course, is the spread of the internet. This is cutting out the censorship of the national media on this subject and spreading the word.
Now, isn't it a bit much to call it censorship, because this problem simply hasn't been on the radar for many years?
I would say it is censorship. As I recounted, after the war, that mention was cut, and it's been off the mention ever since. You get occasional radical mentions. John Pilger and other radical reporters occasionally get a word out, but...
Well, we do quite regularly here. We've had Ben Curtis and the Positive Money people on. What do you make of this, Martin, this idea of the two different directions that countries can be taking within Europe and the Eurozone right now?
Well, I think the Irish have got a general election at the end of this month, and they're contemplating exactly that. I mean, Iceland was able to basically say that they weren't going to cover the bet that their privatised banks had taken. And, of course, they only privatised their banks in 2004. They had a perfectly functional state banking system, which then decided to jump into the party with all these other nutcases in the City of London and bankrupted the country. Now, Iceland's debts have basically been absorbed by the British taxpayer. And when Ireland refuses to pay its debts, as I suspect they will, that will have to be absorbed by the British taxpayer if we're going to carry on bailing out the banks. But I think at that point the British taxpayer is going to rebel and say we're not bailing out the banks. And coming back to your vox pops earlier, it really depresses me when you hear all of these people saying, well, we've got no money, so we've got to cut. It's economically illiterate, and these people are going to be forced to face reality that the deficit by the end of this year will be bigger than it was at the beginning of the year, the economy will be smaller, and in actual fact we'll be deeper in the hole. And that's because people rely upon conventional thinking. All of this stuff, we've had conservative politicians on this show saying you can't spend what you don't earn. It's like if you run a household, you know that you can't do this and you can't do that. Well, if you study economics, you know that you can. In actual fact, what you need to do is have a functioning economy which then generates the resources to solve your problem. If your economy starts to falter, then you actually get less resources, and whatever problems you've got to solve get worse. And I think that's a fundamental mistake that the current government are making, and it's not one that they're going to be able to get away from. They're going to find themselves in deep doo-doo very quickly.
Can I come in on that? This is part of the whole problem right through. The problem with conventional economics is that it accepts the idea that we've got to have everlasting economic growth, and the reasoning behind that is that we've got to have distribution of money, we've got to try and achieve full employment to distribute enough money to the workforce to enable them to live, despite the fact that we're already overproducing grossly. We don't need all that extra work, those extra jobs. We need distribution of the means of buying what can easily be produced and is needed, without having to have ever more longer working hours. And of course, that applies to the people who are in work, while we've got a multitude of people out of work, willing to work, because of the money problem, not because of any problem of supply and demand, but we are running out of resources because we're wasting so much of them.
Now, we haven't got long, Brian, but before we finish, I mean, we've heard this just recently about more bankers' bonuses. The government seems to have its hands tied behind its back. And what do you think about all these various different networks that the banks have, the Bank for International Settlements, organisations like the Bilderbergers, which I've done a website on, because they do seem to be doing quite well out of this crisis. They're, you know, actually increasing. OK, their bonuses have been cut, but their basic pay has gone up massively. So what do you think is the influence of these secretive networks that only a few selected politicians are ever allowed to go to these meetings and to be part of these networks?
Well, I think this is very significant. I think Milton Friedman and John Kenneth Galbraith both recognised that the crash of 1929 was orchestrated, was deliberate action by the banks. They build up the assets until they can create a crash and buy up at fire sale prices all the wealth that people have been developing. And I think the same sort of thing is going on now, except that the problems that have built up are becoming unmanageable.
Okay, can you just give us your website and how people can get hold of copies of your magazine?
Right, well, I have two websites. One, I created a blog in when the crash started called moneymyths.org.uk.
Okay, well, that's all we've got time for. Sorry, Brian. Well, if you just Google up Brian Leslie, you'll find him. Thanks very much, Labour Councillor Brislington East Mike Walcott and Sustainable Economics Editor Brian Leslie. Have a look for him on the internet. Thanks very much and see you next week.
It's the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol.